Chapter 47. Should old acquaintance be forgot? By this time Stephen Smith had stepped out upon the quiet Castle Botherell and breathed his native air. A darker skin, a more pronounced mustache, and an incipient beard were the chief additions and changes noticeable in his appearance. In spite of the falling rain, which had somewhat lessened, he took a small valise in his hand, and, leaving the remainder of his luggage at the inn, ascended the hills towards Easton Delstow. This place lay in a vale of its own, further inland than the West Village, and though so near it, had little of physical feature in common with the latter. Easton Delstow was more wooded and fertile. It boasted of Lord Luxellian's mansion and park, and was free from those bleak open uplands which lent such an air of desolation to the vicinage of the coast, always excepting the small valley in which stood the vicarage and Mrs. Swancourt's old house, the Crags. Stephen had arrived nearly at the summit of the ridge, when the rain again increased its volume, and, looking about for temporary shelter, he ascended a steep path which penetrated dense hazel bushes in the lower part of its course. Further up it emerged upon a ledge immediately over the turnpike road, and sheltered by an overhanging face of rubble rock, with bushes above. For a reason of his own he made this spot his refuge from the storm, and turning his face to the left, conned the landscape as a book. He was overlooking the valley containing Elfright's residence. From this point of observation the prospect exhibited the peculiarity of being either brilliant foreground, or the subdued tone of distance, a sudden dip in the surface of the country lowering out of sight all the intermediate prospect. An apparent contact with the trees and bushes growing close beside him appeared the distant tract, terminated suddenly by the brink of the series of cliffs which culminated in the tall giant without a name, small and unimportant as here beheld. A leaf on a bough at Stephen's elbow blotted out a whole hill in the contrasting district far away. A green bunch of nuts covered a complete upland there, and the great cliff itself was outvied by a pygmy crag in the bank hard by him. Stephen had looked upon these things hundreds of times before today, but he had never viewed them with such tenderness as now. Stepping forward in this direction, yet a little further, he could see the tower of Weston Delstow Church, beneath which he was to meet his Elfright that night. And at the same time he noticed, coming over the hill from the cliffs, a white speck in motion. It seemed first to be a seagull flying low, but ultimately proved to be a human figure, running with great rapidity. The form flitted on, heedless of the rain which had caused Stephen's halt in this place, dropped down the heathery hill, entered the vale, and was out of sight. Whilst he meditated upon the meaning of this phenomenon, he was surprised to see swim into his ken from the same point of departure another moving speck, as different from the first as well could be, insomuch that it was perceptible only by its blackness. Slowly and regularly it took the same course, and there was not much doubt that this was the form of a man. He too, gradually descended from the upper levels, and was lost in the valley below. The rain had by this time again abated, and Stephen returned to the road. Looking ahead, he saw two men and a cart. They were soon obscured by the intervention of a high hedge. Just before they emerged again he heard voices in conversation. "A must soon be in the neighborhood too, if so be he's a coming," said a tenor tongue, which Stephen instantly recognized as Martin Canister's. "A must a believe," said another voice, that of Stephen's father. Stephen stepped forward, and came before them face to face. His father and Martin were walking, dressed in their second-best suits, and beside them rambled along a grizzle horse and brightly painted spring cart. "All right, Mr. Canister, here's the lost man," exclaimed young Smith, entering at once upon the old style of greeting. "Father, here I am," "All right, my sonny, and glad I be for it," returned John Smith, overjoyed to see the young man. "How be ye? Well, come along home, and don't let's bide out here in the damp. Such weather must be terrible bad for a young chap just come from a fiery nation like Indy. Hey, neighbor canister? Apostrophe apostrophe, true, true. And about getting home his traps? Boxes, monstrous bales, and noble packages of foreign description, I make no doubt. Apostrophe apostrophe, hardly all that, apostrophe said Stephen laughing. We brought the cart, meaning to go right on to Castle Botherell afore he landed, apostrophe said his father. Put in the horse, says Martin. Why, says I, so we will, and did it straightway. Now, maybe, Martin had better go on why the cart for the things, and you and I walk home along. Apostrophe apostrophe, and I shall be back amist, as soon as you. Peggy is a pretty step still, though time de begin to tell upon her, as upon the rest o' us. Apostrophe apostrophe, Stephen told Martin where to find his baggage, and then continued his journey homeward in the company of his father. Owing to your coming a day sooner than we first expected, apostrophe said John, you'll find us in a Turk of a mess, sir, says I to my own son, but ye have gone up so, Stephen. We've killed the pig this morning for ye, thinking ye'd be hungry, and glad of a morsel of fresh meat, and a won't be cut up till tonight. However, we can make ye a good supper of fry, which will chaw up well wi a dab o' mustard, and a few nice new taters, and a drop of shilling ale to wash it down. Your mother have scrubbed the house through, because ye were coming, and dusted all the chimmer furniture, and bought a new basin and jug of a traveling crockery woman, that came to our door, and scoured the candlesticks, and cleaned the winders. Eh, I don't know what a hand they done. Never were such a steer, a bleef. Apostrophe apostrophe, conversation of this kind, and inquiries of Stephen for his mother's well-being occupied them for the remainder of the journey. When they drew near the river, and the cottage behind it, they could hear the master mason's clock striking off the bygone hours of the day at intervals of a quarter of a minute, during which intervals Stephen's imagination readily pictured his mother's forefinger wandering round the dial in company with the minute hand. The clock stopped this morning, and your mother in putting end right seemingly, apostrophe said his father in an explanatory tone. And they went up the garden to the door. When they had entered, and Stephen had dutifully and warmly greeted his mother who appeared in a cotton dress of a dark blue ground, covered broadcast with a multitude of new and full moons, stars, and planets, with an occasional dash of a comet-like aspect, to diversify the scene the crackle of cart wheels was heard outside, and Martin Canister stamped in at the doorway, in the form of a pair of legs beneath a great box, his body being nowhere visible. When the luggage had been all taken down, and Stephen had gone upstairs to change his clothes, Mrs. Smith's mind seemed to recover a lost thread. Really our clock is not worth a penny, apostrophe she said, turning to it, and attempting to start the pendulum. Stopped again? Apostrophe apostrophe inquired Martin with commiseration. Yes, sure, apostrophe replied Mrs. Smith, and continued after the manner of certain matrons, to whose tongues the harmony of a subject with a casual mood is a greater recommendation than its pertinence to the occasion. John would spend pounds a year upon the gimcrack old thing, if he might, in having it cleaned, when at the same time you may doctor it yourself as well. He clocks stopped again. John, I say to him. Better have been cleaned, says he. There's 5 shillings. Hat clock grinds again, I say to N. Better have been cleaned, a says again. Hat clock strikes wrong, John, says one. Better have been cleaned, he goes on. The wheels would have been polished to skeletons by this time, if I had listened to N, and I assure you we could have bought a chainy-faced beauty why the good money we flung away these last 10 years upon this old green-faced mortal. And, Martin, you must be wet. My son is gone up to change. John is damper than I should like to be, but a calls it nothing. Some of Mrs. Swankert's servants have been here they ran in out of the rain, when going for a walk, and I assure you the state of their bonnets was frightful. apostrophe, how's the folks? We've been over to Castle Botterell, and with why running and stopping out of the storms, my poor head is beyond everything. Fizz, fizz, fizz. Tis frying no fish from morning to night, apostrophe said a cracked voice in the doorway at this instant. Lord Soz, who's that? Apostrophe said Mrs. Smith, in a private exclamation, and turning round saw William Worm, endeavoring to make himself look passing civil and friendly, by overspreading his face with a large smile that seemed to have no connection with the humor he was in. Behind him stood a woman about twice his size, with a large umbrella over her head. This was Mrs. Worm, William's wife. Come in, William, apostrophe said John Smith. We don't kill a pig every day. And you, likewise, Mrs. Worm. I make ye welcome. Since ye left Parson Swankert, William, I don't see much of ye. Apostrophe, no, for to tell the truth, since I took to the turnpike gate line, I've been out but little, coming to church o' Sundays not being my duty now, as 'twas in a parson's family, you see. However, our boy is able to mind the gate now, and I said, says I, Barbara, let's call and see John Smith. Apostrophe, I am sorry to hear your poor head is so bad still. Apostrophe, I assure you that frying o' fish is going on for nights and days. And, you know, sometimes tis only fish, but rashers o' bacon and onions. I can hear the fat pop and fizz as natural as life. Can I, Barbara? Apostrophe, Mrs. Worm, who had been all this time engaged in closing her umbrella, corroborated this statement, and now, coming indoors, showed herself to be a white-faced, comfortable-looking woman, with a wart upon her cheek, bearing a small tuft of hair in its center. Have ye ever tried anything to cure your noise, Maester Worm? Apostrophe, inquired Martin Canister. Oh, bless ye, I've tried everything. Providence is a merciful man, and I have hoped he'd have found it out by this time, living so many years in a parson's family too, as I have, but it don't seem to relieve me. I be a poor wambling man, and life's a mint o' trouble. Apostrophe, true, mournful true, William Worm. Tis so. The world wants looking to, or tis all sixes and sevens why us. Apostrophe, take your things off, Mrs. Worm, apostrophe said Mrs. Smith. We be rather in a muddle, to tell the truth, for my son has just dropped in from India a day sooner than we expected, and the pig killer is coming presently to cut up. Apostrophe, Mrs. Barbara Worm, not wishing to take any mean advantage of persons in a muddle by observing them, removed her bonnet and mantle with eyes fixed upon the flowers, in the plot outside the door. What beautiful tiger lilies! Apostrophe, said Mrs. Worm. Yes, they be very well, but such a trouble to me on account of the children that come here. They will go eating the berries on the stem, and call them currants. Taste why junivals is quite fancy, really. Apostrophe, and your snapdragons look as fierce as ever. Apostrophe, well, really, apostrophe answered Mrs. Smith, entering didactically into the subject, they are more like Christians than flowers. But they make up well enough why the rest, and don't require much tending. And the same can be said o' these miller's wheels. 'Tis a flower I like very much, though so simple. John says he never cares about the flowers o' 'em, but men have no eye for anything neat. He says his favorite flower is a cauliflower. And I assure you I tremble in the springtime, for 'tis perfect murder. Apostrophe, you don't say so, Mrs. Smith. Apostrophe, John digs round the roots, you know. In goes his blundering spade, through roots, bulbs, everything that hasn't got a good show above ground, turning them up cut all to slices. Only the very last fall I went to move some tulips, when I found every bulb upside down, and the stems crooked round. He had turned them over in the spring, and the cunning creatures had soon found that heaven was not where it used to be. apostrophe, what's that long favored flower under the hedge? They? Oh Lord, they are the horrid Jacob's ladders. Instead of praising them, I be mad why am for being so ready to bide where they are not wanted. They be very well in their way, but I do not care for things that neglect won't kill. Do what I will, dig, drag, scrap, pull, I get too many of them. I chop the roots. Up they'll come, treble strong. Throw 'em over hedge. There they'll grow, staring me in the face like a hungry dog driven away, and creep back again in a week or two the same as before. 'Tis Jacob's ladder here, Jacob's ladder there, and plant 'em where nothing in the world will grow, you get crowds of 'em in a month or two. John made a new manure mixin last summer, and he said, Maria, now if you've got any flowers or such like that you don't want, you may plant them round my mixin so as to hide it a bit, though 'tis not likely anything of much value will grow there. I thought, there's them Jacob's ladders. I'll put them there, since they can't do harm in such a place. And I planted the Jacob's ladders sure enough. They growed, and they growed, in the mixin, and out of the mixin, all over the litter, covering it quite up. When John wanted to use it about the garden, A said, Nation sees them Jacob's ladders of yours, Maria. They've eat the goodness out of every morsel of my manure, so that 'tis no better than sand itself. Sure enough the hungry mortals had. 'Tis my belief, that in the secret soul's oem, Jacob's ladders be weeds, and not flowers at all, if the truth was known. Robert Lickpan, pig killer and carrier, arrived at this moment. The fatted animal hanging in the back kitchen was cleft down the middle of its backbone, Mrs. Smith being meanwhile engaged in cooking supper. Between the cutting and chopping, ale was handed round, and Worm and the pig killer listened to John Smith's description of the meeting with Stephen, with eyes blankly fixed upon the tablecloth, in order that nothing in the external world should interrupt their efforts to conjure up the scene correctly. Stephen came downstairs in the middle of the story, and after the little interruption occasioned by his entrance and welcome, the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.